Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Little BB King. Yeah, we're a little worried. Feels like the street's a little worried about Apple. Tim, you were just talking about it. One of your decliners, shares of Apple down for a fourth day in a row, moving below its 90-day moving average. This after analysts at Piper Sandler cut their rating today, citing a weak macro environment in China that will dampen demand for iPhones. We heard some worries just earlier in the week.
Yeah, that follows the more bearish move by analysts at Barclays, who cut their rating to underweight on Tuesday. In all, Carol, Apple is down 6% in the last 4 days, shedding $180 billion in market cap. We should note there are now five sells on the stock. So that pushes the company's buy equivalent ratio down even further, with the percentage of analysts bullish on the company at a three-year low.
Yeah, so it's interesting. All right, so what's going on? Is 2024 set to take a big bite out of Apple? We've got a great roundtable. Mark Gurman is chief technology correspondent at Bloomberg News. He joins us on Zoom from our LA bureau. And Anurag Rana is senior technology analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. He joins us on Zoom from our Chicago bureau. Guys, thank you so much. Happy New Year to both of you. I do want to kick off with you, Mark. You cover this company like Anurag. You talk with them. You check out their products. You do your channel checks. Should we be saying, Cupertino, we have a little bit of a problem here?
You know, I think 2024
don't take me back there, please.
Yes, could shake out to be one of the most pivotal years in Apple's history. There's a lot going on. They have a pretty, you know, compelling product roadmap for the year. The Vision Pro headset, their first new category in 9 years, larger iPhone displays, biggest change to the iPad since 2018, big changes to AirPods and the Apple Watch. So there's a lot going on here, but, big but, the iPhone sales concerns are a real problem. The fact that we're likely going into our fifth quarter in a row of revenue decline, that's a big problem. That's something that hasn't happened in the modern Steve Jobs nor Tim Cook eras. The fact that this new product category they're launching is not going to have any mainstream pickup for several years or generate any material revenue, that's a problem. The fact that Massimo proved that you could beat Apple in a patent infringement lawsuit and get their product off the market, that's a really big deal. So there's a lot of negative noise around Apple. I still think that the fundamentals, the moat they've created, the ecosystem, the iPhone, people holding on to their devices, buying new services, I think that's all pretty strong. But it just feels a little weaker than it ever has.
Anurag, I see you nodding here from Chicago. tell us your thoughts based on what you heard from Mark.
Yeah, absolutely agree with Mark. In fact, but the only thing I would say is all of this, you know, iPhone weakness came out when they reported results on November the 2nd. That's when we knew when they missed China numbers by a big amount. We had heard about, you know, competition from Huawei. All of those things are important because we were hoping that by this year, we should see a improvement in China smartphone sales. Only because the year before, we had COVID-related problems and there was a depression in sales. I think that really is something that, you know, when they came and gave guidance, to be honest, I was surprised that the stock didn't react the way it's reacting now at that time. So I think it could be a year-end, portfolio management or whatever it was. I agree. This year is going to be tough for them. They're going to grow somewhere between 3-5% revenue. Then you buy, a little bit of buybacks in between. But this is the new normal for Apple. It has been for the last 2 years.
Well, Anurag, let me follow. The new normal, does that mean Apple at some point needs to think about China not being as big a market as it has planned for it to be?
China is a big market.
I know,
for them.
Already.
There is no way out of it. But the way you want to think about Apple in totality, and I'm only going to focus on iPhones right now because that's really what drives the product growth, at least in the near term. When you look at the global market, they have a very high market share in the U.S., which is a mature market. Then the next big market is China, where they have less than 18% of unit market share. But as people become more rich, they go out with and get a more premium brand. Then the next big market is going to be India, where they have less than 5% market share in terms of the units. So the way you want to think about Apple is over the next 3-5 years, the big unit shipment, numbers are going to come from China, and after that, India. In the U.S., we have phones, we're going to refresh it, 3 years, 3.5 years, 4 years, and that's a bit of a saturated market. So China is the growth engine when it comes to phones, and that's where we are seeing some, slowdown.
Hey, Mark, for years, we've been hearing about how the iPhone just powers Apple. And indeed, it does account for more than 50% of the company's revenue. But we've also heard the risks associated with that. What is the most compelling new product category for Apple that will help offset some of this slowing iPhone growth?
It's an interesting question. People for years, like you said, have been talking about, is it a risk that everything revolves around the iPhone and half the revenue comes from the iPhone? I think it's even worse than that because you're buying AirPods if you have an iPhone. You're buying an Apple Watch if you have an iPhone. All these services that Apple are selling, Fitness Plus, TV Plus, Apple Music, the App Store, every time you download an app, where are those downloads happening? It's happening on the iPhone. How many people own an iPad or a Mac and don't own an iPhone? How many people buy an iPhone before they buy an iPad or a Mac? So if you really think about the ecosystem in totality, it is 100% built around the iPhone. This new Vision Pro, to answer your question about new product categories to drive revenue, that's not going to drive revenue anytime soon. If they sell out of all their inventory for 24, you're talking about $3 to $4 billion in just revenue alone, probably about $1 billion in profit, maybe a little bit less. That's nothing, right? I mean, Anurag can get into how minuscule that is. And so I think long-term, mixed reality, augmented reality, virtual reality, those are fine categories for Apple. But I think right now it's nothing more than a pipe dream in terms of that becoming a revenue generator.
Anurag, come on in. You are nodding your head. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as I said, that's why, I would say 75% of my focus goes into the iPhone and the work that's, we do around it. And, at this point, we should have seen an improvement in China. China, there were about 100 plus million phones that need to be refreshed. We haven't seen that number move quite a bit. I mean, in terms of the base is a little bit more than that. But, China is going through weakness. We have a new brand new model from Huawei, but they haven't released in a while. So people are refreshing that. So, I mean, it is a big bit of an issue. But frankly speaking, we really think Apple is a unique brand. Apple is a marquee brand. There is, if you look at globally, the smartphone market, Apple has less than 20% of market share by units. I'm not talking about revenue, by units. Think of Apple very much like an LVMH, like what Coca-Cola was in the 50s and 60s, where as countries that don't have the purchasing power to buy those products right now, as they become more richer, as they become more affluent, they're going to go with a marquee brand, and that's Apple. But if somebody's thinking they're going to grow 10-15%, I mean, they need to recalibrate their thinking. This is at most now a company that's going to grow in a weak economy around 3 to 5%, mm-hmm. in a good economy between 6 to 8%, which, to be honest, it's not bad. This is a brand that can, you know, conquer a lot in the long run.
Right.
But in the near term, we do have growth problems.
Mark, I think that's such a great point. Just got about 20 seconds here. This reset in terms of, they still sell a ton of stuff, guys, but it's not going to be as aggressively growing. We need to think about that just quickly.
It's been the case for years now,
yeah.
you know, in terms of revenue. Apple's very much like the new IBM. In terms of products, they want to prove otherwise, and this is the year to do it.
Listen, guys, thank you so much. We were looking to do a smart roundtable fundamentally about the Apple story, and you guys just laid it out for us so well. Happy, happy new year. Mark Gurman, chief technology correspondent here at Bloomberg News out there on the West Coast, and our Anurag Rana, a must read, as I always say, when it comes to a lot of things going on in the technology world, including Apple. He's senior tech analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence out there in our Chicago bureau. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Stand a little taller. Doesn't mean no longer.
Thank God we have Gina to save us. Yes, indeed, everybody. U.S. stocks have begun 2024 on a sour note. Weakness, though, should be reasonably short-lived, according to Bloomberg Intelligence Equity Strategies checklist of 16 key indicators, which continues to improve for a fifth straight quarter. This from Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Equity Strategist Gina Martin Adams, who is here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So nice to have you here. Happy New Year. Can't believe it's a new year. Wait, can I ask you something? You were here listening to this conversation. What do you make of the buy now, pay later? Is there something within the equity universe? I don't know.
Oh, I think people are less and less cash rich, and Americans love their credit. So if you're going to give them an opportunity for a free lunch, even if they have to pay for that lunch in a month, they're going to take that opportunity, in particular in periods of time when they're a little bit short cash. Mm. And that does appear to be where we are today. I mean, they still have very little debt, which is great longer term, but they are taking on more debt on account of the fact that it's getting more expensive to live. And their incomes haven't really caught up with inflation, even though that seems to be improving in the near term. We've been 18 months in which inflation has been accelerating very quickly relative to income.
Yeah.
And so certain income classes are struggling a little bit more than others. And anytime you give somebody something for free, they generally tend to
fall for it.
So Gina, how do you square everything you just said right now with the optimism that you and the team have for stocks for this year?
Well, so the consumer is not the market. The market is not the consumer is the first thing to consider. There are potential weaknesses in the outlook, and many of them are consumer-centric. But when we look at the composition of our broad equity markets in the U.S., it's a lot less about the American consumer than I think is popularly believed. And what we've experienced...
But we always talk about the consumer, the backbone of the U.S. economy.
Yeah, more than 60% of...
Help me here.
Exactly, I think that's a really good point and something we talk a lot about. It's 65% of the U.S. economy, but 30% of the market cap of the S&P 500 at best is consumer sensitive. Huh. Also, what you tend to see in a normal recessionary sequence is the consumer slows down their spending, business investment crashes as a result of that consumer slowdown, and the business investment is what really creates the cycle. Business investment's already crashed, ISMs are already sitting at all-time near all-time low levels, LEIs have already crashed. We've already experienced our major deceleration. So it's very difficult to get to a sort of mental construct that would suggest that we're not already at or near some kind of low in the economy. Maybe we have a tiny dip lower if the consumer finally capitulates, but businesses have already adjusted. And we see that in the profit cycle as well.
Yeah.
Within the S&P 500 profit cycle, we saw profits capitulate materially in 2022. We went through a massive recession in profits. Profits are starting to claw their way out of that recession now. So I think what's most important to driving stocks, frankly, is earnings. Earnings are not one-to-one with the economy by any stretch of the imagination, and they're certainly not one-to-one with consumption.
I am printing up the t-shirts. Consumer is not the market. Market is not the consumer. Because I think about how much...
I'll buy that shirt.
Yeah, exactly. I'm gonna get it done.
You know, the other thing I'd like to just add into this, because I'm talking about this for a note on Monday, we're so growth-obsessed.
Yeah.
In the U.S., it's all about growth, it's all about growth, it's all about growth. But the reality of this cycle, especially over the last 3 years, that we've learned, or we should have learned, is that we should be a lot more inflation obsessed. And inflation doesn't always trail growth. Mm-hmm. And I think many of us in this market are conditioned on the idea that, well, if growth goes higher, inflation goes higher. If growth goes lower, inflation goes lower. And there's this symbiotic relationship. That's not actually how it always happens. And we learned that the hard way in 2021 and 2022, where inflation and growth really decoupled.
Right.
So I actually think if there's a big risk to stocks next year, it's inflation that remains stickier than anybody anticipated. Even if growth decelerates, that's already expected.
Right.
The whole world is expecting inflation and growth to accelerate.
But we're not expecting
inflation
to accelerate.
I
agree. And like as you think about the Fed minutes from yesterday, they kind of covered everything. We could cut rates, but we could also raise rates. And I do feel like that's the one thing that's being kind of underpriced in the markets.
Yeah, and I think that's just a natural byproduct of the fact that we're all human. We work on recent experience. For the vast majority of the last 25 years, we have really just been able to forecast growth and therefore forecast what was going to happen in markets. Something changed. It broke. And it definitely broke in a hard way in 2022. Forecasting growth was not going to get you to where you needed to be with an investment strategy. So we have to consider inflation and what's going to happen with inflation in all aspects. But I think we're really reticent to do so because we're conditioned.
But it doesn't
really
mean the end of everything, right?
No, it doesn't necessarily mean the end of everything. It doesn't necessarily mean that things are broken. It's just different.
Yeah.
It's just very different than where we've been for most of the last two decades.
Well, for most of the last few weeks, you and the team at Bloomberg Intelligence have been very busy because I got a lot of notes from you in the last few days.
Thank you.
We love it.
We're catching up after the holiday break.
Well, one thing that was really surprising to me in looking back on 2023 and how we can use this to predict what happens in 2024 is the breadth. Especially globally of stocks. We talk so much about the Magnificent Seven. But you and the team crunched the numbers, and it was a pretty good year globally.
I know. It's kind of surprising because I think, again, the popular rhetoric has been, it was just all about
AI.
Seven.
It's
and
all
it's
AI.
Okay
AI.
If you missed the rally because you didn't have the Mag 7. But the reality is we track 20 major global equity markets around the world. 19 of 20 posted returns. 60% of global stocks posted returns. 45% of global stocks posted double-digit returns. Last year, it was one of the greatest years for stocks in the last 25, one of the top six. So we had a really good year in equities in 2023. Not a great year in small caps. Without a doubt, small caps were really left behind. Emerging markets, especially emerging markets when you include China, were left behind. So there were, not everybody benefited significantly, but a great deal of the equity market did do quite well in 2023.
So how do you measure that? Is it the number hitting their 52-week highs?
Yeah.
What is it that you look at?
Yeah, so we look at a lot of different things. We just for that study, we just looked at the absolute returns just to kind of report in on, hey, here's actually what happened. And it looked pretty decent.
Yeah.
I like to look at the percentage of stocks trading above their 50 and 200-day moving average as my favorite breadth measure because I tend to find it gives me some indication as to what to expect for price trend. It also gives some near-term toggles for the equity market. So, for instance, at the end of last year, we got to a point where 75%, more than 75% of stocks were trading above their 200-day moving average, which
That's
is
significant.
It's a very big breadth number, but it's also a bit extreme.
Okay.
And it paired really well with things like our market pulse index, which was saying the market itself sentiment is far too bullish. RSI momentum also got to a very high extreme by the end of the year. So we were set up coming into this year to have a cool-off period. At the very least, we needed to move out of the party that we had in December.
Right. And that's to be expected.
And cool off and let the market find a new equilibrium.
How much of a cool off?
It should be relatively small, just because most of the other conditions that we tend to follow for driving equity markets are pretty supportive. In particular, the earnings trends. Frankly, I think it's kind of gone unnoticed that earnings made a major low in 2023 and are starting to climb out of that low. Most sectors are going to participate in an earnings recovery this year. The 493, so in the non-7 that we talk about, the 493 S&P 500 companies that don't get as much play are actually supposed to produce their first quarter of earnings growth with the fourth quarter earnings season coming up, the first quarter of earnings growth we've seen since 2022. So we should see some earnings momentum gather throughout the year. A lot of it is because inflation is decelerating. It's not because you get a big growth recovery or revenue, but robust revenue recovery. It really is. Inflation needs to continue to decelerate to power that
recovery. One of the
recovery.
Things we were talking about at the end of the year, and just got about a minute left here, is that all the money that's sitting in money markets, do you anticipate that comes back into the equity markets this year? Or how are you
thinking
about that?
Yeah, I think you've got to get probably a stronger recovery in small caps and a broader recovery into all stocks. Probably need to get the Fed to ease.
Okay.
Because then that changes the math Right. Right now, the math is not in favor of stocks relative to cash because the P/E ratio is so high, with the exception of small caps. The math works very well for small caps, which are trading at incredibly low valuation ratios. So your earnings yield on small caps is pretty strong relative to cash, particularly if we go into an earnings recovery this year. But large caps, it's a harder case to make. So you'd say small caps and emerging markets, those are the two markets to watch. If we get some momentum there at the same time, we get a little bit of Fed ease, those could be the areas of the market that really trigger a broader move into the equity market.
More so in,
like everything coming
very
together.
Briefly, more so into the equity market than into the bond market from money market funds?
Yeah, no, I think that right now investors are considering all options because you still get a plenty of yield in the bond market as well. But we've had such an extraordinary rally in the long end of the curve. It's probably more in the short end that they consider their options in the bond market. Also, I would be remiss not to note that, you know, cash and equities are not direct substitutes for one another. And so certainly there's an array of opportunities for investors to consider.
Ah, the God here. Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Equity Strategist Gina Martin Adams. Her research always a must read. Thank you so much. Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too. Thanks for having me.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
One of the biggest news stories of the last year was the demise of San Francisco.
Right. Like it was over, right? Everybody's leaving. It's falling apart. Businesses don't want to
Real
be there.
Real estate is collapsing.
Yeah.
The problem of the unhoused is huge. There are drug addicts everywhere. It was a doom loop. It became critics' shorthand for problems wrought by remote work and drug addiction, a cycle that drove people out of the tech capital of the world in huge numbers.
But here's something, folks. Reality really hasn't caught up with this list of woes. In the 12 months ending July 2023, the city actually gained 4,900 residents after also seeing some slight growth in the prior year. This is according to some new data. So, you know, our team here at Bloomberg News, we kind of wanted to know, like, what's going on here?
Well, look at the numbers. Priya Anand certainly did, technology and venture capital reporter. She took a look at the greatly exaggerated demise of San Francisco. She writes about it for today's Bloomberg Tech Daily newsletter, which you can sign up for at Bloomberg.com/technology. Priya joins us from our San Francisco bureau. Priya, it has been about a year since I've been in San Francisco. Carol and I had a pretty good trip there.
We did.
In December of 22.
Right.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Yeah, we had a good trip there.
Mm-hmm. And I know people were like, be careful walking in the street. I'm like, I walk around New York. I'm like, am I going to be okay? You're going to be okay.
Yeah, you're going to be fine. It is a beautiful city. One that's very, certainly as a Californian, very close to my heart. What prompted you to write this story? Because it was a personal experience.
You know, I was walking the Crosstown Trail in San Francisco. It's a 17-mile trail path that goes through different neighborhoods in the city, takes you to lesser-known places, more-known neighborhoods, ends with a gorgeous view of the Pacific Ocean on New Year's Day with some friends as sort of an annual tradition to be out and about in the city on a beautiful sunny day. And the whole time I was just thinking, you know, there's so much conversation around San Francisco being in decline. And of course, I'm not saying because I had an enjoyable walk through the city one day, there aren't challenges in this city, right? I think anybody who comes here, lives here, experiences life in San Francisco is going to agree that homelessness is a huge crisis for this city. The drug crisis
has been for years.
A big problem.
I feel like homelessness has been a problem for years there.
That's right. These have been longstanding problems that San Francisco really must grapple with and deal with and find a way to solve. But at the same time, there's been all this conversation around how the city's over, it's in decline, but the data is not bearing that out, right? I mean, I received some, this is a very polarizing topic though, and clearly folks around the country who do not live here do live here. People have a lot of opinions on this. So I wrote this story about how the numbers show that the city actually hasn't lost much of its population over the last few years, which is in contrast to a lot of the conversation around how this place is decaying. But I received some pretty charged reader feedback, actually, more than usual. One reader compared San Francisco to Afghanistan and Detroit. I was surprised to see Afghanistan in that email, though, pop up as a point of comparison. So people clearly have a lot of feelings about this place, but I'm not quite sure how much those people have actually spent time in San Francisco. And once again,
or
there
Afghanistan?
Are plenty of challenges for the city.
Or Afghanistan.
That's probably also
well
true,
said.
Right? The city's chief economist, though, isn't saying that these problems don't exist. And he told me, look, there is a risk that San Francisco could enter a doom loop at some point if the city responds in certain ways to its challenges, if the city were to alienate its tax base to the extent that people would leave and then create more of a drain on its finances. But the data has not proven that that doom loop is actually here now. There are risks, and the city has to manage this time kind of carefully while people are still looking at remote work and the ability to not necessarily have this be their center of gravity in the tech industry especially. But this is still a place where people in the tech industry are coming in multiple days
and
a week, lots
you,
of companies.
And as you point out, Priya, it's also a place mm-hmm. where venture capitalists continue to deploy money to companies that are based in Silicon Valley. So talk to us
That's
about
right.
the data that you found there.
That's right. So while there have been all these other cities that have been gaining more venture capital dollars over the years, you know, more and more startups have cropped up in New York. There was a lot of hype around Miami and the startup scene for a little while. Hype more so than I think that actually bearing out in the numbers. The Bay Area by far still gets the most venture capital dollars. And at the end of the day, AI companies now are cropping up and opening offices in the Bay Area. They are mandating that their workers come in 3+ days a week. OpenAI famously has folks in the office almost every day. They're based in San Francisco. I wrote a story last year, I guess I can't say earlier this year now, we're in 2024. I wrote a story in the fall about how AI companies are snapping up more office space in San Francisco. Not necessarily downtown, in other parts of the city. So downtown still has its challenges here for sure. But AI companies are opening up offices here. They're trying to get their staffs to actually move from other parts of the country and the world to San Francisco because they believe there is a gold rush right now in that sub-industry within tech and that they need to capitalize it and that having people together in person solving problems in this burgeoning field is the way to do it. So there is a lot more fervor around being in San Francisco in person than there was early last year, and AI is a huge part of that.
I love your like emotion behind this because it's really great to hear. Because you're right, the story, the narrative has been one of a doomsday, no doubt about it. What about tourism? What are we seeing? I mean, I think it's a beautiful city. Every time I go, it makes me so happy because it's just gorgeous. And
it doesn't hurt that the Bloomberg office is literally on
the water.
Like, if you see Priya's shot, like that's what you see from the Bloomberg office.
It's pretty incredible. Cool. But just got about 45 seconds left here. I mean, tourism, you're seeing them out and about?
There's been some rebound in that, and if you go out into, you know, restaurants in the city these days, like, you gotta have a reservation to go anywhere great over the weekend now again. Unlike, you know, the early stages of post-pandemic life where everything felt like you could go anywhere. But look, I'm not, you know, this story is rooted in the data. It's rooted in my reporting on this industry, which I have been covering for about a decade now. And I'm not, you know, I want to be clear that this whole storyline is not about woman went on a beautiful walk in San Francisco, thinks the city is great now, right? I'm not blind. This is based on the data. It's based on the facts.
Great story, and really something that I think it's good to get this perspective out there, considering the backdrop. And I love your perspective on it, because I get it. I get where you're coming from. Priya Anand, thank you so much. Happy New Year. She's technology and venture capital reporter at Bloomberg News in our San Francisco bureau. And, you know, I brought out the homeless, not to say that, yeah, to remind them that there's, you know, it's been around for a long time, but yeah. I feel like people kept bringing it up like, look at the problem. And maybe it got worse coming off of the pandemic, but it's been something they've been trying to grapple with for some time.
And San Francisco is by no means the only city that's dealing with this right now.
No.
We here in New York are certainly dealing with it as well.
Anywhere it's warm or there's, you know, better.
It's not even warm here.
Yeah, that's true. It's not exact. Anyway, really fun to check in with her, Priya Anand. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
You can't see it. It's electric. Wait a minute. Am I at a wedding?
No, because I wouldn't be dancing if we were at a wedding.
Oh, that's so sad. The electric revolution. A year ago, EVs were all the rage. It seemed like an all-electric future, Tim, was just around the corner.
You know what's funny?
What's funny?
This is off script, but Katie Greifeld.
You dancing in the studio?
No. Yeah, that's true. Katie Greifeld just bought a new car. She posted about it on her Instagram, so I think it's fair game for me to talk
about it. She's talked about it on air, yeah.
And I said, why didn't you get an EV? And she said, you know what? It wasn't even on our radar.
Yeah, it wasn't.
It's a little bit of a different situation because she lives in New York City and it's like hard to charge. But just the fact that it wasn't even on her radar, I think speaks volumes about the way that consumers are thinking about EVs.
No EV in her household.
No.
All right.
It was a Genesis that she got.
It is a Genesis. Yeah. Today's car buyers definitely having second thoughts about them, or having no thoughts if you're Katie Greifeld. Short-circuiting sales growth and causing plug-in models to pile up on dealer lots. Tim, automakers, we know they're pouring more than $100 billion into developing EVs this decade alone. They're now slashing prices, production, and profit forecasts for the new green vehicles.
Yeah, Keith Naughton writes all about the inventory that's piling up when it comes to these EVs. He's Bloomberg News auto reporter. He writes about it for Bloomberg Business Week. The story in the upcoming New Year Ahead issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It's on newsstands next week. It's already online, though, at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg Terminal. With more, we have Keith Naughton joining us this afternoon. Also here is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber, here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Joel, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to both of you, and Keith, to you as well. So the Year Ahead issue we do every year, and we have this process of identifying themes and ideas and stories that we want to kind of dig into. And look, like the EV one is a huge one, in part because of those big numbers that you threw around there. The industry has just gone all in on this. What has been a little surprising is how consumers have been more tepid. And that is somewhat different than I think it is globally, but you know, Americans have their own way of doing things, and this seems to be no exception. What's interesting, though, is that instead of going all gas, and we'll have to grill Katie Greifeld about her personal decisions some other time, one of my favorite topics, by the way. But Keith, hybrids been around for a while, and yet this is what Americans seem to be turning to if they're not going fully electric.
That's for sure, Joel. And in fact, we wrote about that in Business Week a couple of months ago. Hybrids now are all the rage. So Ford and Toyota in particular this week announced, you know, really great hybrid sales up by double digits. People are seeing it as a sort of a good compromise between, you know, going all electric and sticking with the traditional internal combustion engine.
So what's this, how's this going to play out for electric vehicles? I mean, $100 billion into developing EVs this decade among U.S. automakers. Those prices obviously getting slashed, but so what's it going to look like? How do you, you know, if you're going to throw all this money into that and then start to tack, how does this end up playing out?
Yeah, well, as one analyst said to me at one point, this is not a light switch kind of flipped. We don't just suddenly go from having, you know, 250 million internal combustion engine cars on the road in America to suddenly being all electric. There's going to be a progression. It's going to be in fits and starts. But what happened last year, as one dealer said to me, is that the pivot just happened very quickly. They went from having long waiting lists for electric vehicles. You remember all the stories we were writing a year ago? You just couldn't get one. To now having, they have 114-day supply of electric vehicles on average on dealer lots right now, compared to an industry average of 72 days supply. So they just have tons of electric vehicles that aren't selling.
Tim, your dad was among them who was waiting forever.
Yeah, he waited for, gosh, maybe a year for his Mach-E, and now there's no problem getting Mach-Es. It's kind of wild.
No, in fact, Ford this week just put a discount on the Mach-E, $7,500 off lease deal.
Oh, maybe he should have waited.
Maybe he should have.
Sorry, Dad.
So, Keith, what is it, though? Is it...
Yeah, he should have.
Let's call him up and find out.
Yeah. Oh, he's listening.
Well, that, you know, we have talked so much around this table about the expensive price. I know Elon's been cutting, and I know now we're seeing it, but nonetheless, how expensive EVs are. Is it just a case of we've tapped into kind of the wealthier market already? They've bought their electric vehicles from now, and it's just not as appealing, certainly from a price point, to kind of the mass buyer.
Yeah, you're right, Carol. And Tim's dad and Katie are good examples. Tim's dad would be an early adopter. Mm-hmm. He's someone who wanted the latest technology. He's willing to pay up for it, not wait around for the discounts. And Katie is a pragmatic mainstream buyer. And they're looking at EVs and saying the price, the average price of an EV is $60,000, about $13,000 more than a traditional car, which is already up to begin with anyway. And they're also looking at the charging infrastructure. And in places that are not California, there aren't a lot of chargers out there. One of the dealers I spoke with has dealerships in Kansas and Nebraska and Colorado. And when he does his weekly 200-mile commute between Omaha and Kansas City, there's one charging station.
Wow. Yeah.
But isn't this what the government's for, to step in here and be like, look, that shouldn't be a problem. Let's create let's make sure the infrastructure is there where we need it, and let this, you know, industry not languish. Who killed the electric car, yeah. Keith? Isn't that the movie?
Yeah, I think it was the movie. The government is spending billions on you know, buttressing the infrastructure, expanding the infrastructure. But we're still trying to figure out what plug it should be, because, you know, Tesla has one type of charger, which the industry seems to be moving to, but there is a completely other type of charger that's available. So we still have sort of a VHS and Betamax thing going on with charging stations. And by the way, they're not very reliable, J.D. Power has found over and over again. Well, many are broken.
It's not just that...
That's what's crazy.
It's not just that the charging stations are unreliable. It's that you actually reported, and Carol and I were surprised to find this,
yeah,
that there's some reliability issues when it comes to the batteries in these vehicles.
Absolutely.
Keith. I thought EVs were supposed to be maintenance free, mm-hmm. never have to change the oil. All you got to do is change the tires every, 1,000 miles or something? No, I exaggerate, but you do have to change the tires more frequently.
Well, that is certainly the dream. But the reality is that electric vehicles have 80% more problems than internal combustion engine vehicles. And as you said, most of that problem is with the battery and the battery taking a charge. I talked to Jake Fisher, the head of auto testing at Consumer Reports. And what happens is people plug in their car. This is not the fault of the external charger. This is not a charging station problem. It's a car problem. They plug in their car and it won't take a charge at all, or it will take a charge for a little bit and then it shuts off. He compared it to not being able to put gasoline into your internal combustion engine car. It's a no-go proposition.
Oh, that is not...
That's
Joel, you have an EV.
I was going to say, guess I should disclose here that I drive a Tesla Model Y. Have never had that problem. I've never heard of that problem. But
were you a relatively early adopter?
Relatively. It was on the... No... It was like within.
But you are unique in the sense that you're actually. Forgive me if I'm giving up too much about you.
Yeah, it's fine.
But,
we've talked about it before.
You live in New York. And it's not an ideal place to charge. New York City, it's not an ideal place to charge an EV.
So here, Keith, this is actually a good segue into another thing I want to talk about. Because there are charging stations that you would use if you were out doing the 200-mile kind of drive that you were describing there, that one of your sources had. But, you know, for most people who have electric cars, they charge at home, right? And there are plenty of homes that have power outlets that you can plug into and charge up overnight. So why is that, from a commuter standpoint, since that's what most Americans are typically using their cars for, why isn't this working and resonating there?
Right, and that is the idea too, is to have a charger in your garage. A couple of things on that. Let's start again. The car's average price is $60,000. And then to install a charger in your garage, because you don't just plug it in like a lamp, that's another $2,000. So you have to be a fairly wealthy individual, present company excluded or included, in order to afford all of this expense. And mainstream buyers are balking at that expense. They're saying, I mean, internal combustion engine cars are too expensive on their own at $47 on average. They were closer to $30,000 back in 2019. So there's been this huge price inflation in cars in general, and EVs are priced like luxury cars.
Mm. Just for the record, I use superchargers when I need to on the road, and then have, you know, wall outlets on the other side that I can charge with whenever I'm going.
My cousins who live in the city who have a plug-in hybrid can plug in the garage that they pay a monthly fee to park in.
I guess it depends on how quickly you want to charge. But we are ultimately talking about a ton of energy required to this. And it does speak to, Keith, like, you know, when I first bought it and I was paranoid about running out, you actually discover that the place that you, in an emergency that you would need to go, is actually like RVs. Destinations, they have the outlet that you need. So if you're ever really in doubt, it's like, the, you know, you need the 220 and you pull in.
Is that
the,
listed in like the...
No, it's just like, you know, you start reading up on how, what happens if you're, you know, in desperate times and desperate places, and RVs are...
You figure it out,
so,
right?
RVs are the answer.
So Keith, is...
Some Americans know, you know?
Well, Joel knows now. He could write a book on it.
And now you know.
I'd like to see the RVs and all the Teslas.
I've never had to use that. You know,
there's an interesting mix of crowds, right?
No problem.
Keith, is ultimately the final destination when it comes to cars here in the U.S., is it ultimately going to be electric?
That is certainly the way the regulations are heading everything. You know, President Biden wants us to be at 50% electric by 2030, and by 2032, two-thirds electric. That's kind of a stretch goal, as far as the analysts in the industry say. But it could be, coming back to the hybrid point that Joel started with, it could be that we have more of an immediate hybrid future, and that's going to be more of the mainstream market. Remember, electric vehicles represented only 7% of sales, you know, last year. So fewer than 1 in 10 vehicles sold in America is electric.
One thing I'm curious, it's a global auto market. And if you look overseas, whether it's Europe or China, as you point out in your story, they are doing better in terms of adoption. So if the U.S. lags, like it seems to be doing at this point, Keith, what disadvantage does it put the U.S. at versus the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, we already see it in batteries. China owns the battery market. You really can't have an electric vehicle without a Chinese battery or Chinese minerals or Chinese components. So China is already leading the race. But obviously, the Chinese government can dictate how the electric vehicle market is going to develop. I talked to one China expert, and, you know, if you live in Shanghai and you want to a license plate for your internal combustion engine car, you pay $12,000. If you want one for your EV, you pay nothing.
Yeah. And as
that'll shape policy.
As Bloomberg has reported before, like the cost of even going on a big road trip with an EV in China is cheaper than it would be with a gas car. I mean, they have fundamentally just changed the pricing dynamics in
a
way
that power generated that they used to charge.
Well, they keep building solar, right? Okay. But I mean, look, no doubt they have tons of coal. So, yeah. But the fact that they were able to bring that price down the other amazing part about the Chinese version of this, there is one adapter. You know, you use, it is a unified system. There's no amazing confusion.
Right. Yeah.
They've just said, this is a better way. And I will say, just, you know, a little propaganda from the editor of Business Week. Once you go electric, I think it's hard to go back.
Oh, it's amazing.
It is. I think it's a better technology. It's just getting people to do it and believe it. But then once you do it, you're like, wow, this is more fun.
My mom drives the car more than my dad. And she's pretty much giving up driving her car.
This is how you sell it to Carol. You know how many places I take my dog now because I have dog mode in my car, electric car? He just goes with us everywhere. You just put him in the back.
It keeps the dog cool.
Yeah. You just set the temperature. Dog's in the back. And then he's not alone at home. You know? Keith, have you movable dog crate?
Keith, have you gone electric? You've driven a lot of electric cars. Have you gone electric? Just five seconds.
I've driven a lot of electric cars. No, I drive an internal combustion engine car.
Why?
But yes, it's more convenient here in Michigan, where I'm based. Yeah. And I think what you see, part of the reason that the U.S. has been slower to adopt is we're a big country with wide open spaces.
Yep.
That's very different than Europe.
That's a good point.
What a great story. Keith Naughton, thank you so much. Happy New Year to you. Keith Naughton, of course, Bloomberg News auto reporter. And our thanks to the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber. The dog thing, you may have got me.
Yeah, see? gotta know your audience.
This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving, crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody. We've got just about 18 minutes left in today's trading session. And the markets, you just heard Charlie break in it down. A little bit of a mixed trade. Higher on the Dow, a little bit lower, though, on the S&P and NASDAQ. It does feel like we're kind of limping into 2024, but we've got a big jobs report. Having said that, late last year, you probably read this on the Bloomberg, Bloomberg News highlighted the stock optimists who nailed 2023. Among them, Tim was Ryan Dietrich.
He's chief market strategist at the Carson Group. He expected the U.S. economy to avoid a recession last year, Carol. Mm-hmm. He also bet inflation would cool sooner than the market was expecting. Ryan even added exposure to stocks during the banking turmoil in March and as the S&P 500 sank in October. Looking like a pretty good series of calls.
Congratulations, Ryan, because you were highlighted in our story. Happy New Year. How confident are you making a call for this year?
Well, happy New Year, guys. Thanks for having me back. I mean, we're still pretty confident, right? We still, will we gain 24.2% on the S&P this year? History would say probably not. But we think low double-digit returns makes a lot of sense. And again, we can get into all the details, but we just still see a strong consumer, likely with housing coming back, with manufacturing showing signs of bottoming, that the odds of a recession, in our opinion, are still quite slim. And when you can avoid a recession, stocks tend to do well. And here's one more. I mean, I know the S&P hasn't made a new high for like exactly 2 years, right? 2 years ago yesterday.
Right.
And we think we're going to hit one eventually here. We're not that far away.
Well, we talked about this too.
14 times. Well, what's that? Go ahead.
No, but I was going to say, for in the last 2 years, the S&P, if you really look at it, has really gone nowhere. But forgive me, I interrupted you and you had a smart thought. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I don't know how smart it was. Okay. We'll see. You let me know. But yeah, for 2 years, we've gone nowhere. But here's the thing. Since 1950, Carol, I found 14 times the S&P went at least a year without a new high. So a long time without a new high. We're in that scenario now. After it makes a new high eventually, and it will this time, we're pretty sure. We're pretty certain. 1 year later, S&P's up 13 out of 14 times, up like 15% on average. So I hear so many people saying, listen, we're up a lot last year. We moved a lot. That is true. But zoom out, literally stocks have almost gone nowhere for 2 years. And that might be a reason to be bullish for investors.
What about when it comes to the technicals at the start of the year? When, because I know, Ryan, you have, I mean, I follow you on, I was going to say Twitter. I follow you on X, where you're always tweeting about these technicals. The S&P 500 down for a third day in a row. It has had, we don't know how it's going to close, but it might close in the red. If it does, it will not have closed in the green once this year. It's only been 3 days, but does that portend anything for the rest of the year?
Yeah, we would say no. I mean, it's awfully early. Let's remember here, S&P's up, as you guys talk about, 9 weeks in a row, right? You look at the future returns after 9 week win streaks. It's pretty solid 6 and 12 months later, above average. Now, listen, I'm aware, right? We just had the Santa Claus rally period, the last 5 trading days of a year, and then the first 2 of a new year. And we were negative, right? And that's pretty darn rare. And you go back the last 30 years when we didn't have Santa Claus come to town during those normal 7 bullish days. January's been red a good amount of time. First quarter's been flat. So maybe we're due for a well-deserved break here, but we need to see more worrisome signs, Tim. Specifically, where's the leadership coming from? Like, are utilities leading? Is healthcare leading? You know, staples leading? Some of the more defensive areas, we're not seeing that yet. So the message of the market to us is we're probably just maybe due for a well-deserved break. And we still think that, one more for you, it's the first quarter of an election year.
Yeah.
Historically, you look at all 16 quarters of a 4-year presidential cycle. This is one of the weakest quarters. So just kind of be aware. And last year was obviously a good year, right? So be aware, maybe we're in that time frame where we could catch our breath, perfectly normal. We don't see any major warning signs cropping up just yet.
Do you want defensives to rally, or would that be a sign that things are coming undone a little bit?
Yeah, no, that would be a great question, Carol. I mean, that'd be a sign things are probably coming undone. We don't want to see that type of leadership. I mean, you know, you look back in 2021, right? You know, or late 2021, defensive started to lead. And we all know 2022, all the spiral that happened. So there was some warning signs in late 2021 that maybe something's off. We're not seeing that, though. I want to be very clear. So we're encouraged by that.
What are some things that could change your tune? You say you still see a strong consumer. The odds of a recession are slim. What would make you say the odds of a recession are no longer slim and they're looking more likely?
Yeah, I mean, we love to follow the credit spreads and credit markets. I know I came on with you guys a lot last year. I think you talked about these things. What are the triple B spreads, investor grade corporate spreads? Keep it fairly simple. If there's a monster under the bed, we think the credit markets would show it. Back in March when we had the regional bank crisis and obviously a lot of worry, we didn't see credit spreads blowing out. So we saw that was an opportunity. We saw the same thing in October. So that to me is one that we're going to watch. And then on our team, you know, I know, hopefully I can say the F word on the radio, the Fed, you know, the Fed.
You made our producers in the control room a little nervous there,
Ryan.
Did
I just freak them out? Sorry.
Paul Brennan is like, you know.
It's my joke.
Paul pulled out all his hair.
Yeah. Oh my God, he did.
No. The Fed. You know, could there be a potential policy mistake? We think the Fed could start cutting pretty soon, right? We were on that record, like you guys talked about when I first came on, that they could, but now maybe they can stay a little hawkish, and maybe that could upset the apple cart. We don't expect that to happen in the market. Boy, the market's voting, right? I mean, 6 cuts, it might be a little high, but I mean, that's something that could be out there as well. But all here's one more for you. When you have a good end of year rally, like we just did, up 14% for the S&P the last 2 months of the year, when you gained at least 10% those last 2 months, only happened 6 times. The full next year has been higher. six times, up 20% on average. So I call that like a slingshot, right? I mean, when you have a lot of strength to end a year, history would say, listen, price side with that following year still being pretty strong.
It's a shame you don't have any kind of bull feelings out there, right?
Wait, hold on.
I want to ask you about Apple, because you and I talked about this
quickly,
off air.
So then I can get my question in.
Apple's below its 90-day moving average. Is that problematic? Quickly, because Tim has a question.
I mean, for tech, potentially. I mean, Apple, we all know, is very large. One of our big themes, we've been talking about it for a while, is that rotation from large caps to small caps and mid caps and technology to industrials. We're seeing that. So sure, if you're overweight tech, that's a potential concern. But I mean, there's a lot of other groups that I think are going to take that baton, Carol. And that's just the next phase of this bull market as we move forward, in our opinion.
Okay, Ryan, have you been at all bearish in the last few years? Be honest.
Yeah, we were neutral equities, you know, the majority of, I guess, let's see, 2022, right? And we moved overweight equities late of October of 2022, or November of 2022, actually. So were we outright bearish? No, we were not. But we were even weight, and we had overweight fixed income as well. We've been underweight fixed income, overweight equities, really, since the end of last year. So, you know, we'll see. But, you know, it makes sense. I mean, listen, 71% of the time the stock market's up, 9% on average. We get all those things, but we've definitely thought there's some opportunity here, and we still think that's that's the case, Tim.
Small caps, mid caps, financials, those are still your three favorites. That's what you told our print team. Just 20 seconds here, real quick.
That is exactly right. I maybe throw industrials in there as well. Those cyclical areas, if you don't have a recession, this rotation from tech and large cap to the smaller names, the cyclical names, that's how we're positioning the models that we run for our Carson partners.
All right. Well, great to check in with you on this, these first few days of 2024. Ryan Dietrich, he's Chief Market Strategist at the Carson Group, joining us on this Thursday. You are listening and watching. So you got your question in.
I did.
This is Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success. It's discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management and investment banking firms in the industry. Stifel. It's where success meets success. Start your journey at stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.